Welcome, everyone, to the Deep Dive. I'm Paul. That gentleman is Ian Boyd. Welcome to Inside Texas Football, powered by InsideTexas.com. We want to make sure you like this video, subscribe to the channel. We want to definitely hear from you in the comments. We always love hearing what you have to say. And Ian's already lording his Topo Chico over me because I'm out. So that's how it's going to be, I guess. Well, I'll remember that later in the Q&A, Ian. All right. Hey, we want to answer your questions, and you've got a bunch of them. You've got a really, really good ones. One thing that I love about our viewers and our readers at Inside Texas is they're very thoughtful and they ask really good questions. So we're always excited to answer them. Ian, you ready to get started, buddy?
Yeah, let's get to it. I guess we got quite a few things to get into.
Let's go. I think the general sentiment for this team this year is that our weaknesses, in quotes, DT, O-line, running back, are more so question marks slash unknowns than true vulnerabilities. Do you agree, number one, is this true across the board? Or would you say there are definite weaknesses to this roster that we will have to game plan or scheme around?
I think there are some definite weaknesses.
I agree.
You always have to lean a little bit into question marks versus weaknesses in college football, because they're all young guys. And, dude, like we were – before we went on air, you were talking about how you had written up some of Weiser's weaknesses from last year, and then he said, but watch next year, he'll add 20 pounds of muscle and go beast mode and make me look like just the biggest simpleton. That kind of thing happens.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think they have some definite things that are going to have to be schemed around.
Well, we were also deprived of a spring game, so we couldn't really get eyes on some of these guys where you can go, ah, okay, now I see their developmental trajectory. This is good. Or you see a guy and you go, oh, he's kind of plateaued. Interesting.
That was such a win for me in my argument that you can actually learn a lot from a spring game. And then such a huge L for me because now I can't learn anything from a spring game because nobody does them anymore.
Yeah, I don't have deep insights into Connor Stroh right now, Ian. I'm sad to confess. And I mean, a spring game would have been helpful.
That's such an edge for an offseason analyst.
All right. So what do you think are the larger weaknesses or vulnerabilities? And he specifically, let's limit it to the DT O-line running back conversation.
Well, I was gonna say coverage in the secondary.
Well, let's limit it to what he wants to talk about.
Sure.
What do you think?
I think the definite weaknesses are, I don't know if they have anybody that's like a real game changer at running back. I don't know if you can lean into that. And then I don't think you should count on dominating anybody with the O-line. Anybody like good, anybody really good. They're going to need another gear for the top defensive fronts. I don't think they're going to be able to just – we're going to do what we do when they play the best fronts. You?
Yeah, I noticed you omitted defensive tackle, which has been a big source of consternation in the offseason. I kind of feel like we just threw enough bodies at this that we're going to create a pretty good floor.
Yeah.
No one's expecting a combo of Murphy and Sweat or Collins and Broughton or even Ojimo. As your third guy. But I do think that we've got enough bodies that we can figure this out. I would encourage everyone to think of this big DT room as a big tryout rather than tenure. So some of these guys are one-year rentals. We know who those are. But the rest of the guys, they're here to audition. And if the audition doesn't go great, you'll see them transferring out next year. So that's what we brought in five so we can find two or three. If that makes sense.
I think we know that they're going to be able to get in the way in the run game and not get just mauled by the vast majority of teams. And then I wanted to say that I don't know if interior pass rush is going to be a strength, but I'm not confident yet to say it's a weakness because a couple of the guys are more question marks there. Like if Marad Watson or maybe Justice Terry or even I don't know, maybe even like Travis Shaw were actually pretty good in the pass rush. You'd be like, oh, you know, wasn't counting on that, but it doesn't shock me.
Yeah, I think the main thing for these guys is I just want to see the pocket displace I don't care about their ultimate stats.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you want that pocket to collapse a little because we're going to have withering pressure potentially coming from the edges and from our blitzers. We've talked about this before, but this is – we have an assortment of guys who are 6'3", 240, and can run like a cheetah. And that is not a fun thing for an offense to face. But you can step up in the pocket and have these guys fly by you if you don't get that collapse on the interior. So we really have a premium on getting those guys to work that center and those guards back into the quarterback's face so he can't flee forward to elude some of our chasers. Running back, I'm in agreement with you. We were ranked third in Pro Football Focus behind Notre Dame and Penn State preseason. I think that's absolutely nuts. But, you know, I don't know what to say to that. I just think that I would love for this room to surprise us and for some guys to get really healthy and be even much better than they were before they got injured. That's really what we require to level this up. But as you said, crazy stuff happens in off seasons. People develop, and that can happen at running back. Absolutely. So we'll see. O-line will be very interesting. I think you'll have an interesting dynamic in that I expect our tackles to be pretty good pass protectors, but maybe deficient against physical run defenders. Particularly teams are going to – here's a prediction. A smart defensive coordinator with the right personnel is going to play four eyes on both of our offensive tackles and force basically our run game to be predicated on offensive tackles getting displacement, and it won't happen. It's going to be very frustrating. Interestingly, our interior may get better push in the run game than last year, but I think they're going to be a little more vulnerable as pass protectors because, you know, say what you will about Hayden Connor as a run blocker, one of the great guard pass protectors that we've ever seen at Texas.
I don't like that prediction, Paul.
I know.
That's a little bit alarming. And I was watching Ohio State spring game the other day, and I was like, oh, you know what? I bet they actually end up playing three down this year, and they're going to do exactly what you just said.
Oh, let's move to question number two. What does an upside scenario look like for each of your question marks, and how likely is that scenario to unfold? We kind of addressed that a little bit with running back. We just don't know. I mean, you're asking us to handicap Christian Clark's durability after coming off an Achilles. The spring reports were wonderful, and I'm so happy for him, but I want to see it under live fire. Same thing for CJ Baxter. He just recently got cleared to be a full go and a full participant in everything, to include 7-on-7. That's really exciting. That said, I don't think people realize the degree to which he shredded that knee. LCL, PCL, like the whole shebang. So counting on these guys to be stars, that seems really optimistic to me. What do you think? Is there one position group that you want to talk about what the upside looks like?
Maybe D tackle. Like we just mentioned, they have kind of a floor where they could probably run out different duos every week based on the matchup.
Yeah.
And be like, this week is going to be a lot of Shaw and Brevard, and we're just going to build a wall against the run. And then this week we're going to try to hunt with Watson and see if we can get him into the backfield, etc. But there's another upside scenario where somebody just like puts it all together. Like January, Watson, those two seem like the most talented to me. Actually, maybe Shaw again, because he just seems like a freak who just needs the conditioning and full buy-in.
Shaw has a knee historically that's been plaguing him. So I think he just might be a guy. I think part of that is because he got overweight, so it's more pressure on that knee. I think part of it is he just has a bad knee. So he might be a guy on a pitch count, just no matter how well he's playing. If Shaw like plays great, he still might be on a pitch count just because we know that it's going to tail off if we play him 50 snaps every week instead of 25. Brevard, I've actually watched. No one's going to push him around.
Yeah, I don't know if he's going to be – he's probably not going to be Sweater Murphy, but he's going to be like maybe Coburn.
Yeah, I mean, he just is not a guy you're going to push around even with a double team. Yeah. And that's a very valuable guy in college football in general and in Pete Kwiatkowski's defense specifically. So
I think he'll be a Minch all year.
Yeah, and we may play our defensive tackles to eat blocks and just let all those dynamic linebackers and edges we talked about just eat. And there's nothing wrong with that approach to football. Number three, at what level do these units need to perform at not to hinder the team achieving their 2025 goals? So I'll bring in a new unit that we haven't been discussing, wide receivers and tight end, just pass catchers in general. They need to be pretty good. I think Arch is going to elevate them, or at least some of the things that Arch can do will play better to their skill sets, like specifically Jahondre Moore, maybe Parker Livingstone applies there. But that whole group, so I don't think we will have any one receiver as impressive as Matthew Golden last year or A.D. Mitchell or Xavier Worthy when they were really feeling it in 2023 in individual games. But in the aggregate, I wouldn't underestimate even the Stanford transfer that came in. You know, he does some pretty good, heady things. He can't carry your wide receiver core, but he's a really nice complement if DeAndre Moore plays well and if Ryan Wingo can level up a little bit. What do you think?
Yeah, for the millionth time, national championship season hinges on Wingo or maybe Moore being really good.
A dude.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
For sure.
Agreed. I think to Ian's point, the DB group really needs to be on point. As you guys probably know, I'm writing my Thinking Texas Football preview, the 13th annual, Ian, lucky 13. And it's a nightmare. And I also love it because I'm coming up with stuff that I hadn't fully realized doing like deep dives, true to our name here. And one of them was this fact: Malik Muhammad and Jalen Gilbo have combined for 33 starts at Texas. And they've had over 50-something appearances in addition to those starts. Pretty tenured, experienced guys. If you include forced fumbles and interceptions, how many turnovers collectively have those two forced in their entire career at Texas?
Yeah. Is it zero? One?
Manny Muhammad had an interception 2 years ago.
I knew it was low.
Neither of them has ever forced a fumble.
Muhammad played a lot of press man last year. It's just kind of X this guy out or not based on the opponent. For Gilbo, it's much more damning, I think, right? Because he was in the nickel. He was in the middle of the field every snap.
Well, and I also just think active – hard-hitting or opportunistic playmakers find a way to take the ball.
Yeah.
You know, Michael Taft hits guys really hard, and sometimes they fumble.
Yeah.
You know, Taft breaks on a ball across the field just because his instincts say to do it, and he ends up with an interception. Makuba, of course, was wonderful at it. Jade Barron, turnover monster. I think we will have a couple of guys who are big turnover creators. Derek Williams, if he's back healthy. Jelani McDonald. But that is something interesting about Gilbo and Muhammad in that they're more parts of the system than potential playmakers, at least to date. If you want to win a national title, our secondary needs to turn people over. They can't just be in the right spot.
Well said.
Thank you. Let's move on. What are the things to look for in a running back recruit that mark them as a real difference maker? Bijan. And not just a very good running back, Jonathan Brooks.
I love this question. We both dislike Jonathan Brooks as the example of just a very good running back. I think Brooks, when you look back at him in history, like 10 years from now, you're going to see something similar to like when we went from Vince Young to Colt McCoy. And like people eventually realized Colt McCoy was awesome. But you go back and watch Colt McCoy now, like 15 years removed. And you're like, Colt McCoy was an elite athlete for a quarterback.
Yeah.
But he did not look that way. If you're like me and you were younger and newer to football, and you're watching him right after Vince Young. I think Jonathan Brooks will have a similar, if you watch him in the future, you'll be like, boy, Brooks was awesome. And it wasn't always obvious because he followed Bijan.
You know what I like about him bringing up Bijan and Brooks, though?
What's that?
It's a good jumping off point for some of the elite things that they do that are not gross measurables. They're not spark scores. By the way, Bijan had a good spark score.
Yeah.
But if you recall, coming out of high school, I don't think he ran a good time or something, right?
It was a 4.7.
Yeah. That improved, obviously. Yeah. But also, it didn't really matter because if you were seeing what he can do, his quickness, agility, all that is just so remarkable at his size that I think they're actually great running backs to talk about if you're sort of a connoisseur of running back evaluation. And so the gross measurables matter insofar as we can't take a guy who runs a 4.9 and weighs 180 pounds, right? It's just not work. I don't care what his other traits are. It ain't working. However, what it reminds you of is it's not always those spark scores and the gross measurables for a running back, particularly in high school, that are the difference makers the next level up. The difference makers are contact balance, vision, ability to know when to go fight for a tough yard and when to bounce it out. Because let's face it, Ian, if you're a 4 or 5 star high school running back, it's almost always time to bounce it out, right? But you want that guy who understands, no, it's 3rd and 3. I got to bury my head and my shoulder pads and get the hard 4. Yeah. But I think for me, contact balance is huge. The ability to break tackles is the most important and least talked about and underrated trait in running backs.
I got a different one. That one's very good. Do you remember when Madden had this 1 year where they had like the quarterback vision? And you could only see the field clearly if you put the quarterback's vision in the – if you put that part of the field within his vision. And, like, if you played with Tom Brady, it was, like, super wide. And you could see and if you played with, like, a, I don't know. I played with Ben Roethlisberger, and they did not think that much of his. Yeah. I think running backs have a similar range of gaps they can reach. And if they go left and they start getting going left – like some, for some it'll shrink, for some they can still get back to the right. And that sort of lateral ability to jump cut or just move sideways and be able to threaten multiple gaps so that you can wait for linebackers or whatever to commit and wait for the blocks to develop. That is something that we watched and we saw on Bijan and Brooks film.
Yep.
And also on Clark's film, Christian Clark. That's what the most exciting thing about him to me was those guys for whom the range of gaps that they can hit as the play advances stays wide. The guys that go really fast through a hole in high school and then they just blow by everybody, it's like, that's not going to happen. You're not going to get straight line paths against good teams. You have to create them.
That's important you mention this because this is in the context of evaluating for high school. Far too often, we have gotten overly excited about a KD running back running through a 9-foot wide hole, right? And this has afflicted recruiting evaluators year after year, right? KD running backs did this every year. And you're like, well, this guy's a 4-star. And it's like, he's got an amazing system and a great offensive line, and he's running through huge holes. And you're not learning a ton about this guy. And I think that's important. I think your idea of threatening multiple gaps, you almost have to think of the modern running game as a game of hide and seek between the linebackers, the second level defenders, and your running back. And you're sort of, as a running back, trying to suggest where you're headed, get the linebacker to commit, and you're a better athlete than that linebacker. And then you cut it the other way against the grain, right? And you're trying to make him commit. And that's one of the things that you'll hear good running back coaches instruct their pupils is press the hole. And what they mean is don't just run to the hole that you're told to run to blindly, but do get to the line of scrimmage where your hole's supposed to be. Because one, the hole might be there and just run through it. Or two, you're pressing up into the line first of all, it limits the linebacker's vision of you. But secondly, that forces the linebacker to trigger. And you're a better athlete than the linebacker 97% of the time. If you're trying to make your cuts deep in the backfield, the linebacker reacts to that, just takes the appropriate angle, and it's a one-yard loss. So I think you make a very good point. Now, the question is, when the linebacker does contact you, what happens?
Yeah, yours is also...
Do you just fall down?
Or when you get the linebackers out of position and you get through, but then the safety's there.
Yeah.
Because everybody's playing with a safety deep.
Yep.
But watching the run to get there late, can you run through him, or is he going to knock you? Are you going to... Is he going to turn a hole into a two-yard game?
Your favorite word, mid, Ian, when properly used, actually does mean average, right? But we use it actually to mean suck. But an example of a mid running back is you get the hole blocked right. They burst through. There's a safety in front of them. There's green on both sides. And they run into the safety. And you're just like, okay. You know, that should be a 60-yard touchdown, and you made it into a 13-yard gain, because we're not going to block it this perfectly that many times this season. So when it happens, yeah, when it happens, you got to house it.
Bijan and Brooks were really good at, they were like moving, they had juked past the linebackers in their first couple steps. And then they were setting up that safety.
Yes.
So there, that kind of like advanced chess playing is another indicator. This is why all these things is why I'm not very broken up about a certain Carthaginian heading down to College Station.
Hannibal?
Yeah, because whenever I see Hannibal's deal, I'm like, how much of this is Hannibal and how much of this is just the other side doesn't have elephants? And this guy, this Hannibal guy is... He might have like a wide range with his lateral agility, but you don't, I don't know if you get to see it that much to know if he even knows how to use it.
Yeah.
It's open.
I haven't watched his film at all, but I'll be curious to go check it out after this and see if I agree. I don't know anything about Carthage. Justin Wells, I'm sure, can go an hour and a half on Carthage. So
Justin Wells does not share this opinion.
Interesting. All right. Well, interesting. Got a final thought on Jonathan Brooks. One of the things I love about him is the subtlety of Brooks, because there are many times when you'd see him make a really good run for Texas and you go, oh, that was perfectly blocked. And then you rewind it and you're like, oh my God, he broke a tackle and made another guy miss. I didn't even see that. Like, and it's so weird. He'll be running and like, you'll see a guy break down on him and he'll do something really subtle and the guy kind of falls down.
Yeah.
And you're just like, what did he do to him? And then you have to actually slow it down to see. With Bijan, you actually see what he did to the guy, because it's so like remarkable. Like, and he does it in the NFL to people, to NFL athletes all the time. So yeah, it's a fun thing to talk about, but I would say the gross measurables are great. If you can get Bo Jackson and Adrian Peterson, awesome. Take them all day. But look for vision, look for lateral agility, and look for contact balance. Those are big parts. That's what I look for, and I think Ian does too.
I try.
You know what you need to look for? In your mortgage, Gabe Winslow. You can reach him at 832-557-1095. He is the elite jump cut of the mortgage game, but he's not going to juke you out of a great deal. He's going to be the guy who provides the great deal. He's not limited by just his system. He adds to the system. He's really great at what he does. Go read his Google reviews. There's people that come on Inside Texas or the YouTube and they rave about the service they got from him. He's a great guy, really hardworking and extremely sharp. Former National Merit Scholar, UT grad, got a law degree, dramatically overqualified to be doing your mortgage, but nonetheless, let's exploit it and take advantage of it before, you know, the United Nations snaps him up and makes him an arms inspector or something. So Gabe, thanks for supporting us, and we'll make sure our watchers and viewers support you. 832-557-1095.
All right, Ian. Keep Gabe out of Iran. That's our mission here.
What's that?
Our mission here is to keep Gabe from being sent to Iran.
That's right. Five hottest seats in college football. Power 4. Oh, I'm sorry they said Power 4 because I wanted to go with Trent Dilfer. And you can't say Brent Venables, Ian.
I can do whatever I want, Paul.
You know, we love our customers, and the customer has created
what we're allowed. This is Joe Cook's question.
It's what?
This is Joe Cook's question. It's not a customer.
Oh, okay. Well, forget Joe Cook. But he specifically says you can't say Brent Venables because that's for you. So you can't say Brent Venables. I think everyone knows this is an important season for him. Let's move on further down the list. I'll give you one. Mike Norvell, a guy who 2 years ago was listed among the top 10 coaches in college football, right? Last year, they crapped the bed. They went 2-10. That team was poor, and they did a poor job of evaluating the portal. They were not 2-10 poor, Ian. They were 6-6 poor. They had a bunch of guys quit, frankly. And my thought is, unless he turns it around, I don't think Florida State is content to sort of be irrelevant in football. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm looking at his buyout deal. They restructured it a little bit, but it's still going to be, looks like $60 million maybe to fire him.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they had some big talk from their donors about how they were willing to spend $200 million to get out of the ACC. I never believed that. That was classic blustering lawyer who's too obsessed with the local football program kind of talk. I don't think if they were so bad last year that if they're really bad again, it's like, there's no way, right?
I would think they have to make the move and just eat it. And then you'll see them probably sponsored by the nation of Qatar in 2026. They also put it like venture capital.
Them and another team that's on the list, surely Arkansas.
Yeah.
They may have cheap in-house options to save money.
That's right.
Because the Arkansas, for anybody that doesn't know what I'm talking about, Arkansas's offensive coordinator is Bobby Petrino. If you feel like him and Taylen Green have been good and the overall program's just not there, just fire Pittman and promote Petrino. Florida State, you can get a similar effect this year because they just made Gus Malzahn their offensive coordinator.
I don't know if I want old Gus to be my head coach at Florida State, but it's
– I don't really either, but if you need a cheap option to change things out
– if you're like, in for a penny, you're in for a pound. If you're going to fire Norvell, go hire a coach. Like, go get Dillingham.
Or Dilfer, I thought you were about to say it.
What?
Go get Dilfer.
You go get Trent Dilfer. You load up the Brinks truck, and you don't let him say no. Let me give you another one, Ian. Not far from your old neck of the woods, Luke Fickell at Wisconsin. What a tremendous disappointment he's been. And a very interesting example of a head coach who elevated himself at Cincinnati. Elevated them into the playoffs, right? But if you look at his staff, you start to realize maybe this is what elevated him. It's Marcus. It's guys like Marcus Freeman. It's guys like, just an incredible Cincinnati staff. And you'd say, well, he gets credit for creating that staff. Well, when he went to Wisconsin, he did not recreate that staff. He hired a spread coach to coach, to be his OC at Wisconsin. No huddle spread. We're going to throw the ball around. Completely not reading the room on your local genetics and your local culture, right?
Yeah.
And just completely botched it. And here's the kicker, Ian. Wisconsin, by far the hardest schedule of any Big Ten team. Not even close.
So the only thing is he went this time and he got Jeff Grimes to replace.
He did.
I love that fit.
A lot of zone and outside zone, right?
As long as they have – and it is conducive to using fullbacks and tight ends if you want, which they very much could. Yeah, that was weird. That when they hired Fickell for a huge pile of money, I was like, wow, I can't believe Wisconsin pulled that off. What a coup. And then he hires Phil Longo, and I was like, oh no.
Well, and they also had Jim Leonard, right, on the staff who gets Wisconsin.
They could have hired Jim Leonard as the head coach. He was the interim.
Yep.
And they're like, no, we can go get Fickell. Why would we settle for Jim Leonard when we could get Fickell? Yeah.
Well, you know, it's wild, Ian, and you probably are sensitive to this, although you moved up there a little later. But, you know, prior to Michigan's emergence and Penn State sort of raising their game, Wisconsin was the second best program in the Big Ten for a good stretch.
Yeah, I think I caught the tail end of it even when they had
But it does show you how when you're built a certain way on a certain premise and a certain culture and an understanding, if you tinker with that, they assumed that they had a natural floor that they did not have.
Yeah, exactly.
So here's the bummer, Ian. Grimes might be a good hire. Fickell may have found religion. They might still go 5-7 and get fired. Who you got?
Mike Gundy.
Yeah.
There's some people in Oklahoma State that are just ready for something new. There's a lot of people in Oklahoma State that have been ready for something different than Gundy for a long time, which I know it's ridiculous, but that's just human nature, right?
It is.
And so they see it. Let's say that you've always been a little like this on Gundy. You're like, he's great, but then we lose to Oklahoma and we don't win the Big 12 championship, right? And so you're like, I don't know. Gundy just never quite gets us there. If we could just do these extra things, we could finally get there, and Gundy's holding us back, right? And then you see all these changes in college football that also seem to be putting Oklahoma State further down the ladder. And you're like, and we're stuck with Gundy.
Yeah.
And they don't realize that he's actually keeping the trapdoor from engaging, right?
Although in fairness, last year the trapdoor engaged. Gundy's a guy I always had a ton of admiration for, because he was able to sort of do more with less in a different way than Patterson, like in his prime, but yeah. Still just very impressive, very fluid in how he hired, how he trained people for the job. He had amazing amounts of turnover, not really through any fault of his own, just because he kept hiring good coaches and they'd get hired to bigger programs. And he would always come back with a good hire. And I just thought that was always very impressive. And he could play different ways to beat you, which I always thought was admirable. That said, I think the shine is off, and I think he's very vulnerable. I think you've nailed it. I don't think Oklahoma State has a good understanding of where they fit in the current Big 12, though. And I think I would put my money on Arizona State, Texas Tech, and Utah, and BYU to be sort of the standard bearers. But Baylor and TCU are, at their core, a better program than Oklahoma State.
Do you know who else they have to deal with now that they didn't have to deal with for the vast majority of Gundy's tenure?
Houston.
Yes. I guess. SMU.
Yeah, true.
Just to have this like super rich school in the middle of the heart of Dallas all of a sudden trying again.
Well, and part of the premise of Oklahoma State is we've got to be able to go into Texas and get 3 stars.
Yeah.
And then develop them to our system and our fit. That's how we're going to be good. They're not going to be good recruiting Oklahoma, Kansas, and the dregs of different junior colleges. It's just not going to happen.
I think also, I don't know if Gundy's culture is as, I don't know if he's has the energy or the political capital to be as strict and demanding in their culture as he was in 2011 or whatever.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of things apparent to slow that down.
You're a happily married man with a wonderful family, beautiful, kind wife. But let me run something by you, Ian. If you were to run down to Cabo one weekend with a stripper, and then you came back to your wife and said, sorry about that, I was, you know, what's wrong? Everything's fine. How would that go over? Not great?
No. That would not be great.
Welcome to the world of Mark Stoops.
Oh, yeah.
He ran off to College Station with a more attractive program. And then when it all fell apart and the Aggies revolted, the Aggies are revolting, Ian. Indeed, they are. But when the Aggies revolted against the hire, he has to go back to Lexington and say, oh, sorry about all that. Oh, no, College Station? I spend my summers there. It's very beautiful. It's like the Paris of Texas. I think that there's a rift between the fans and Stoops as reflected in last year's performance, that I don't think could ever be repaired. However, he's got a massive contract and a massive buyout. Does Kentucky want to eat that?
I'm going to tie this all back to where I always wanted to go.
Uh-oh.
I think Bob Stoops could find him a landing spot if he gets fired.
Where?
Norman.
Oh, get out of here. They're not hiring Stoops.
Yeah, he'd be like Jim Nagy. He'll be totally compliant. He'll be in charge. Mark will do whatever you say. Just go get NFL players and he'll mold them for you.
You're setting up a Roman hinterland puppet state. This is Ian, OU has agency. They don't want to do the things that would make you most happy. They want to try to do things that would make them. Sure? The last 3 years might be proof. Look at it. It takes that victory swig of Topo Chico. Dude, that is awesome. It's not going to happen, but I do love the thought. And we were not supposed to bring up Venables, but
Jim, you still managed to get it. I know Dillingham said no. I know all these other guys said no, but Jim, my brother Mark.
You could fully realize your player personnel vision with Mark.
Yes. And we can get him for cheap. We just need to chip in like 30% of the buyout.
If you think the Aggies revolted hard against Mark Stoops, wait till you see what happens in Norman.
They can't do nothing. Oh,
man. Ian's really enjoying the worm turning on our rivals to the north. All right. Do we have any more coaches' hot seats, or we go to the next question?
No, let's move on.
Let's go. Unless a coach makes a significant innovation, how much of the game comes down to the talent of individual players and the team with the aggregate of those players, the largest aggregate of those players? Let's answer the first part before we tackle the follow-up question.
A lot. Especially if you're talking about national championships. I had said maybe there's better old examples too. But to me, the major innovation of Saban was like total war approach to college football.
Yes.
Like, how can I get more and more and more resources invested into football so that we have just this overwhelming advantage on the field? And he would chase tactical upgrades all the time as well, and was responsible for a handful himself back in the day. But his big advantage was just, how do we get the biggest aggregate? 100%. And it's hard to beat that any other way except matching it. Like, Texas's climb of late under Sark has been matching it, right?
Yeah, I think the key caveat to this question was, unless a coach makes a significant innovation, because we have seen multiple instances in the history of college football where you can make a significant innovation and ride it for a while to tremendous success, perhaps even greater than your talent. Mm-hmm. But once you get caught up to, boy, it dissipates quickly. And you saw that with the wishbone in the late 60s and early 70s.
Yep.
You saw that with the advent of the spread. So Bob Stoops, to his credit, and I always give him credit for this, he was the first coach of a real major program that said, hey, the spread is not just nonsense, fun football for like a lower mid-tier program to be relevant. This is a legitimate way to play college football. And OU rode that to a national title along with a really good defense. So
innovative.
Sorry?
It was also innovative on defense with speed and base nickel and things like that.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, people forget that, you know, running a nickel defense was considered an innovation in college football in the 90s.
Yeah. So it was a sub package thing deep into the 2000s.
I remember watching an old SEC network game with the Florida Gators, the Spurrier Gators.
Oh man.
In the 90s, and they were playing someone, and the announcer was literally, I'm not exaggerating, was going nuts about the fact that Florida was in three wide. And then they went in trips. How do you play that as a defense? There's three players on the same side. Now, Spurrier went to the NFL where that concept was not so innovative, and you saw the results that he had there, right? He went from being like this great college innovator to like just a guy in the NFL. And so he sensibly went back to college and had more success. But I do think that the talent of the players, look, it's the Jimmys and Joes. It's a huge deal. I will add one part to this because we tend to think of innovation just in terms of these big wrinkles. I'll also say don't underestimate the value of teaching someone to play their position really well.
There have been some teaching innovations too.
True. But I'll give you an example. Connor and I did a live Tuesday where we went over the most players in the NFL by program.
Yeah.
And Georgia, Ohio State, Alabama, Texas now is in the top 10. Amazing, right? That 23 guys getting drafted in 2 years will help you. Yeah. You know who was pretty darn respectable up in the top 20, 25? Iowa.
Yeah.
Well ahead of several other programs with much more talent. And I'll tell you what, they developed the hell out of defensive backs and offensive line, which is the most guys that you have on the field, right? Modern college football, you got five offensive linemen, you got five DBs. Those are the two most important position groups because you got the most of them on the field other than quarterback. Iowa's decided that quarterback does not matter, right? So you got a bunch of those guys. And then
they also
say the thing you notice about Iowa football players, it's not so much like these remarkable schemes. They just play their position really well. And that's clearly what their position coaches emphasize. Playing your job, playing your role correctly and intelligently rather than obsessing about schematic perfection.
They also at Iowa emphasize not always to their own betterment techniques that the NFL wants. So that helps too.
Yeah, but I mean, their program has had success.
They teach it well. They teach it well. It's right. Just funny that it doesn't help them win more.
Well, I was just using the NFL as a corollary or a proof, but of what we already know is which Iowa wins a lot on the field, surprisingly, right? And this is one of the reasons. Follow-up question. What have been the biggest offensive and defensive innovations in the last 20 years?
The spread, which is still within the last 20 years. Maybe RPOs in particular.
I was going to go there.
RPOs, and then nowadays defenses have actually kind of surpassed offenses in the NFL and college level, because what happened was RPOs and these other offensive tactics were so overwhelming that it actually had a refining effect on defense rather than a like just breaking the game. You know what I mean? Like iron sharpens iron kind of deal. So like the tactical adjustments that have been made for defenses that would probably otherwise not have happened have really dominated the last like 5 years maybe.
Well, I'm speaking to the author of Flyer of a Football, available at Amazon right now. And you coined a term for a certain defense that we saw all throughout the Big 12 and two other parts of college football.
Yeah, the flyover defense. Flyover defense is doing okay right now. But the one of the main ideas behind it of presenting a conservative shell and coverage and encouraging the other team to try to run and then just taking your chance fitting the run with players backed off, playing downhill, that you see that in like every defensive scheme now, whether they use that particular style or not.
Yeah, sometimes it's just a changeup.
Yeah.
But everyone incorporates it. I'll say the other thing, a certain technique, the 4-I. Lining up your defensive tackle or your big defensive end or maybe even a normal-sized defensive end directly on the tackle.
Yeah.
That was a significant innovation. And it was an interesting adjustment to how people were running the football and teaching the running game. And you saw some coaches as disparate as Iowa State's Matt Campbell, Dave Aranda, Baylor, when they won the league. Obviously, Todd Orlando had success with that when he had the right personnel and sort of didn't get found out on his back end. But yeah, I think that's been a pretty significant innovation as well, the 4-I. Ohio State used that quite a bit to great success last year.
Yeah, it's pretty that and that is spread around, and then also the Michigan Texas play two edges, let them play wide and aggressive, and then put like two basically nose tackles inside. That's actually been the bigger. That's been more the best practice that people have opted for than the flyover.
If you have sufficient talent.
If you're a big school and you're like, well, we don't want to stop recruiting edges. Edges are fun. Then you go the 2-4-5 Texas Michigan way. And if you're a smaller school that can't get the big fun edges, you should do the flyover, honestly.
All right, let's move on.
I like this one.
One thing I've been wondering about and would like to hear you discuss in the deep dive is the backup quarterback phenomenon. The most recent example is the SEC championship game where our defense was dominating the starter and controlling the game. Could you shed some light on what factors play into a backup quarterback's ability to enter a game completely cold and immediately start moving the ball down the field, doing so on a consistent basis? What should be an advantage somehow turns into a disadvantage? And that's hardly the first time that's happened. This is a fairly common thing. Why does this happen?
It does happen quite a bit. I think here's my explanation. You know how like my guy Parker Fleming has this meme that he posts a million times every Saturday in college football season where it's the guy from American Psycho. And he's like, nice, very nice. Now let's see the unscripted drives.
Right.
Because you see over and over again, teams get the ball. It looks like it's going to be a shootout. Both teams march up and down the field on their first drive or two. And then they get away from the collection of plays that they specifically practiced and designed. So what I think part of what happens here is the backup quarterback comes in and he's got almost a script of plays that they practice with him all the time and his QB2 reps. They're like, here are the things that he's good at. Here are the things we know he can do. And then they bust those out. And if you're the defense, it's all new. It's like facing an opening script again. And then on top of that, you probably didn't spend that much time game planning for it. If his skill set is markedly different than the starters, then it's a whole different style that you haven't practiced against. And so those first couple drives could be damaging. And then if he's mobile, then maybe he runs around and makes a couple extra things happen when you're tired after that.
I think you nailed it. I'd say there's one other element.
What's that?
As a defensive coordinator, when you see a new quarterback, your tendency is let's play base.
Uh-huh.
And some defensive coordinators go, no, 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 there's blood in the water. Let's attack this guy. Let's make him prove that he can make a couple of throws that would punish us. But if you're in a close game, a defensive-oriented game, as we were against Georgia, your tendency is to go, all right, let's just run our base and see what this guy's up to. And I would say particularly that is a PK tendency. So if you actually specifically go to that Texas-Georgia game, it's instructive. Georgia's was dominated in the first half. We somehow didn't get any points from it, but our defense dominated Carson Beck, right? And we knew everything they were going to do. The second half, their first drive, they go for a touchdown. And it was largely Gunnar Stockton throwing the ball.
Yeah.
On sort of base looks. Then after that, we adjusted and he was reduced to sort of throwing screens and running. And then Georgia really had success in the second half running the ball, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Etienne had a big run. Frazier had a couple of big runs back to back, like 20 yarders that got them a field goal. But we kind of got control of Gunnar Stockton throwing the ball. In fact, we forced a turnover, which could have been a pick six. I don't want to get into it. But I think we had an initially fairly passive reaction to seeing a new quarterback, and we got punished by it. And over time, I thought in the second half, we adjusted to Gunnar Stockton being in the game. You know, and then the last play of the overtime, I'm not sure how you don't understand that's going to be a handoff, but I don't know.
My favorite example of this, or my least favorite in some sense, is in, I think it was 2002. It was 2002 or 2001, actually. I'm not totally sure. But Nate Hipple came into the game for Oklahoma in the Red River Shootout, nursing a dozen injuries. And the announcers kept talking like, go for Texas, put hits on this quarterback, knock him out of the game. And they did that. It's like Carl Reese, right? Or Ed, what was that guy's name?
Carl Reese.
Carl Reese. Blitzing like crazy. They knock Hibble out of the game. Awesome. Here comes the backup, Jason White, pre-knee surgeries. And he just starts scrambling and running around. And it was like, oh, no. We were way better off when the gimpy, struggling starter was in than when this guy was in.
I will say the one thing about this is you notice when it happens because it seems anomalous. This happens. The backup comes in quite often and stinks. You just don't notice that because you expect it. So I'll give you an example. In another very close Texas OU game, 2009, we knock Sam Bradford out of the game.
Yep.
OU's defense dominates us for most of that game. And it's very close, 16-13, I think. We actually win on a wrinkle of Colt McCoy running the ball.
Yep.
Like quarterback draws and like counter. But we got Sam Bradford out of that game early. That was very beneficial. Now, there's the other side of that where Caleb Williams comes in the game for Rattler and then takes over the game. And also, Rattler has been benched, had another quarterback come in, be ineffective. Rattler comes back in the game and was effective. So we've seen every side of this, but I would say mentally, we do tend to make note of when the backup quarterback plays well or we don't adjust to them. Versus when the backup quarterback comes in and stinks, you just expect that, so you sort of forget about it.
Almost all these examples, the quarterback is mobile, who came in also.
It helps.
Because Landry was not mobile. It was just a less developed version of Bradford. White was mobile. Caleb Williams came in, obviously, did all his damage with his legs. Gunnar Stockton came in and did a lot of damage with his legs. So that added wrinkle when you haven't been – it just changes the geometry of the game. You got to adjust live. That's not always easy.
Yeah, another proof on this is the Texas-Georgia game in Austin where their defense dominated us. Quinn obviously had a really bad game. I've heard people write or say, man, we should have put Archie in that game. We did. You forgot. It didn't get any better.
Yeah, and he actually made a couple plays too, but then he fumbled. So
that's it. I mean, the point is we tend to forget. Had he come in and won the day, this would be a legendary, like, all-time memory, right?
Oh, man.
But that's how it is. So, anyway, let's move on. I think this is a good question, an interesting one. Are we done?
I think our producer is cutting us off.
Oh, yeah, I understand. Well, we're going almost an hour here on the deep dive. This was a deep and long dive, and I enjoyed it. So, thanks for the questions, y'all. We really appreciate it. Please like and subscribe to this video. Please offer your thoughts in the comments. And we definitely want to see you over at Inside Texas. It's the best possible place to get all of your sports info, not just Longhorn stuff, although Longhorn stuff is the specialty. It's the best info out there. Nah, I'm not going to say it, but I just say sometimes I'm exposed to information from other venues and I'm shocked at how little insight there is into what's actually happening. So I think this is the place to be. We'll see y'all over at Inside Texas, and we'll see you guys next week on the Deep Dive.